I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Motz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Tortoise.
Hello, it's James. This is a bonus episode of The News Meeting, because if you had a chance to listen to the conversation we had at the start of the week, trying to make sense of the news, there was so much that we hadn't really dug into with Chris Anderson, the head of TED, about the thinking behind his book, Infectious Generosity. The strapline to it is The Ultimate Idea Worth Spreading, that I wanted to take some time to try and understand an idea that's appealing on the face of it, and you wish it were true. And so, Chris, I wanted to start there. Infectious generosity, how much have people said to you that's wishful thinking?
Oh, they definitely start there. You, Pollyanna, come on, the world isn't like that. Don't bring me your kumbaya, wishfulness. So the book's intended to be an argument and actually comes from a start point of extreme concern about where the world's at right now. Like, to me, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the world is mean and getting meaner, and I'm terrified by that. I really think we're in danger of being unable to solve the problems that we need to solve because we've stopped talking to each other. We don't just disagree with each other. We're disgusted by each other. And in that stage, you can't collaborate. And I think we do need to collaborate to solve a lot of the problems. So that's where it starts. And it's made worse by the fact that one of the key contributors to that situation is a force which I thought was going to make the world better, i.e. technology, the internet. You know, I am a tech optimist. I certainly was a tech optimist, and I'm determined to try and hold on to that a little bit. But I saw the internet as the thing that would bring people together. And in the last 10 years, it seems to be doing the opposite of that.
But there's an interesting thing about the book, which is obvious, and I should have thought of it before I even started reading it, which is the origin story of thinking about infectious generosity, i.e. infectious in its virality and generosity in its giving away, is TED itself. Right? You made a choice to give it away. Will you just talk through how that happened and what at the time seemed like the risks of giving all the goodies away?
Yes, it was something we stumbled into, really. When I took over TED, it was an annual conference in California. I took it over with the foundation. I was a media entrepreneur. I'd kind of pretty much nearly gone bust during the dot-com crash. But I did have a foundation with some money in it. So it was that foundation that bought TED. And for a few years, the goal was, how do we get these ideas that seem to be quite inspirational out into the world? And we couldn't do it. This was the early aughts. We tried to get it on TV. TV was interested. And then online video came along, and we had this opportunity to share it that way. The only problem was that there was no revenue source, it seemed. So it was, you know, you're going to have to just give it away, which imperiled potentially our conference, which was the whole way, you know, that was our whole business. So we ended up giving away the content, and to our amazement, I mean, the talks went viral. First of all, that was surprising. And then it actually helped the conference because people heard about it and wanted to come to it. And the people who were coming to it didn't mind the fact that they could share it with their friends and family. So it worked out spectacularly well. And it got us getting obsessed with this idea of what else could you give away? Like, this notion of radical generosity in the connected age became something that we obsessed over. And I'm sort of obsessed with it to this day.
And did you think at the time, we're going to kill the golden goose here? People won't come to the conference because they can see it all online.
We were worried about that. We were absolutely worried about that. And I think a lot of people today have amazing things that they are afraid to give away online. For that fear, you no longer have exclusive use of that thing. And so, you know, how do you make money? How do you, you know, whatever. It feels worrying. And I think the lesson of the connected age is that you may be surprised at what comes back. Because first of all, just the scale, the fact that things can spread to an unlimited number of people, and the fact that it costs zero to distribute it, that's just an unbelievable unlocking of potential value. And these things carry with them the most important currency of our age, which is reputation. I mean, you know, if someone gets something lovely, the first thing they go is, where did this come from? You know, and so that's pretty spectacular. I think it changes the rules about what you hold on to.
I thought the book, when I read it, I thought it's a rarity to write a book about ideas that you write so warmly and so personally. And one of the things that really affected me was this idea at the heart of it about, obviously, fast and slow. It naturally fascinates me. But this idea about instinctive thinking versus reflective thinking and how that makes us feel. Mm. How did you come to that? Is that in the reading of other things? Is that in the listening to TED Talks? Is that in your own experience? How did you see that?
I mean, possibly some of it comes from my own religious past, where I was brought up that life was a battle between our inner demons and angels, like very literally. And I think there's a naivety in a lot of secular culture, honestly, that just says, oh, well, people are basically good. So for example, in social media, if we just let people click on stuff and we watch what they do and then we try and amplify that, what can possibly go wrong? Well, what can go wrong is that people aren't just naturally good. People are very complicated. There's good things. Everyone has the potential to be good. Everyone has the potential to be provoked as well, to be made angry, to be made resentful. And everything hangs on which part of us we poke. And the social media algorithms have discovered that the way to gain power and to maximize people's attention is to tap into our ancient fears about threats and anger and so forth. If you can poke those things, people go click, follow, like, you know. And so the voices that have become most powerful on social media are the threat mongers. You know, social media, everyone's discovered their inner Rupert Murdoch. You know, it works to have, you know, anger at full scale, or, you know, to deploy threats or whatever. That's a very, very powerful thing. And so I think people are missing that the way to think about humans at a minimum is that we have this thinking slow, thinking fast part of ourselves. If you like, our instinctive selves and our reflective selves, or as I also call it, our lizard brains. Mm-hmm. And our reflective selves. So social media has found out that it's the lizards that doom scroll. It's the lizards that click on like. And by amplifying that, what it's doing is it's turning us into lizards. But that's terrifying.
But there's a fatalism around, isn't there, which is that lies move faster and more popular than truths, that complexity is too much like hard work and not nearly as appealing or enticing as oversimplifications and downright exaggerations. So how do you set about engaging with the world in a way that does speak to the reflective brain and gets people, not a small group of people there, but very, very large numbers of people to join you there?
Well, this is the goal of the book, is to try and unlock the playbook of what it takes to let the good stuff compete with the bad stuff. Our brains instinctively lead us to the bad stuff. That's what we're drawn to. But it turns out that there are people out there doing amazing things online and in real life that is capable of spreading and causing these beautiful ripple effects if we just paid a bit more attention to it. And the things that, you know, three of the things that really make a difference and can go help something get amplified, you know, just authentic human emotion. Doesn't have to be bad emotions. Authentic, good examples of human emotion. Laughter, delight, wonder, just compassion. If they strike deep inside someone, that they will get shared. Courage. When people are brave, that gets people's attention. Creativity. So if we could figure out ways of telling the good stories that are bolder, more creative, more audacious, more human, we may be amazed at what happens. And it was such a delight, James, just working on this and discovering all of these stories of people who are doing this. And just under the radar, there's this beautiful sort of spread of other stuff. Like, I don't see the online battle as, it's not like 90-10 against us. It's like 55-45 against us. And with a bit of careful intent and careful planning, I think we could turn the tide a bit online and just have a kinder, more hopeful online connection with each other, which will transform how we think about each other.
One of the joys of the book, I should say, is that it's an anecdotal rat-a-tat-tat of goodness. You keep coming across these stories of people who do things. I at moments where I thought, would I? I'm not sure that I'm as good as that. But one of the reasons why it's reassuring, at least to me, is that you seem to be quite persuaded of the generosity of people, that the baseline is really quite generous. And I wondered whether you'd talk through the experiments that you've done at TED in generosity, in giving, and what you've learned about people.
I mean, there's lots of things inside us. As I said, I don't think that people are just all good, but there is a powerful instinct for others' interests inside everyone in the right motives. If we see someone suffering, we will want to do something about it. We may or may not act. There's other things going on, like loss aversion and fear and so forth, but we will want to help. And there's another amazing thing that we discovered, which is there's this deep desire to respond to generosity. So we had a ringside view of this amazing recent social experiment called the Mystery Experiment, which TED did in partnership with the University of British Columbia, where an anonymous donor's $2 million was converted into giving 200 people online $10,000 each, no strings attached, except that they had to report how they spent it. It was hard getting them to accept the money. I think they thought they were being scammed. Like, we would like to transfer $10,000 into your PayPal account, no strings attached. But when they took the money, it was pretty amazing what happened. Basically, on average, across income levels, across seven different countries, on average, more than two-thirds of that money was spent generously. It was given away in some form, some to family, but friends, to strangers, to causes. And what people told me after this experiment was done was that they, you know, it was because they had been given the money. If they'd won the money in a lottery, it might have been different. But because they'd been given the money, they felt this desire to respond in kind. So that it's those two things together that create this sense of the possibility of ripples of kindness. The fact that we have generosity in us and that we're wired to respond to generosity, and we're in a connected age now. Wow. You put those potentials together and we are under-imagining what kindness could achieve today.
And how does reputation play into that generosity? Because one of the interesting things about that experiment, it seemed to me, was that you got really pretty high outcomes of giving, whether or not people knew, as in the public knew, where the money was going.
Yeah, so it's definitely complicated. I mean, in that experiment, there was one group who had to report what they were doing on social media, and the other group didn't. They actually responded the same. That, like, there wasn't a big measurable difference between those two, which
it's the most uplifting thing you can hear.
No, that's right. That's right. People were basically doing it as a response. I mean, I do think that in the connected age, that when you give away things, reputation goes with it. I mean, the TED story, the only reason people have heard of TED is because of the stuff that was given away and spread. And we're very grateful for the reputation that that gave us. And I think the spread of reputation actually is, it should be a reason to increase our focus on, what could we be giving away? Because this is the beauty of the moment that we're in. More than ever, it is clear that if you act generously, you will get a long-term benefit from it. It's hard to do in the moment. You will get a long-term benefit from it, both in terms of people wanting to work with you or wanting to know more about your work, and in terms of reputation more broadly. And by the way, in terms of how you feel about yourself. Like it's all there. So it's hard to do in the moment. It's in your long interest. And even though it's in your long-term interest, it is still generosity in my book. We should still welcome it.
This may be the subject of another podcast or, in fact, a series. But you mentioned, Chris, your religious upbringing. Mm. And one of the themes in the book that I was really intrigued by was your relationship with faith, because you talk about the extent to which your faith had inculcated a sense and belief in generosity and human nature, but you also say that in your 20s, you moved on from believing. And I just wonder why and how those two things square up.
Well, I definitely found it hard to believe that there was a plan, a detailed plan by a divinity for everything that was happening. You know, that it seemed like if that was true, it was a pretty sick plan in some regards. So that was the main reason why I lost faith. But what had kept me in the faith for a long time was that I couldn't picture how someone could basically act unselfishly in a godless world. Like, why? Why not just be in it for yourself? And one of the powerful things to learn was that, like, a full understanding of human history, of human evolution, is that actually we evolved very powerful, profoundly deep instincts to care about other people. It's in us. You don't need a philosophy or a theory or a reason. It is in us. It is part of you. You won't be happy unless you exercise that part of you in some measure. So that's a beautiful thing. And I think it's good for us to recognize it. It's not as widely known as it should be, that one of the secrets to a happy life is to find your generosity journey. We're not just talking about giving away money here. We're talking about acts of kindness, time, of hospitality, of sharing creativity, of sharing knowledge, whatever it is that you can do. That is a key to your own happiness.
And what do you say to people who love the idea of generosity, infectious generosity, but say, Chris, this is a rich person's problem? Anyone who is financially stressed, time poor, emotionally burnt out, says, look, I wish I could give more, but I don't have any more to give. What do you say to those people who I'm sure are respectful of the idea, but feel it's out of touch with life?
I'd listen to them, and I have absolutely no finger to wag at anyone, honestly. Like, everyone's got their own life to live. But generosity is not about giving money a lot of the time. It starts with just literally shifting attention to someone else. Anyone who can take a moment to look at someone else in the eyes, say, "How are you? How are you really?" That is the start of generosity. And even just those words, people just feeling seen, is just a profound gift that you can give anyone. I grew up in Afghanistan, and before all the awfulness happened, and we had traveled to the poorest families there, and they would invite us in and give us tea. And just that act was profound. To this day, when I think of Afghanistan, I don't think war country, I think generous people. And so just simple human things, often the poorest are actually the most generous in terms of how much of their time and attention they're willing to give other people.
That phrase you just used there, human things. Mm. One of the things that I was really struck reading the book was, it's a very human book. It's about how
people behave. And you might well have sat running TED and thought, you know what, I'm in this incredible spot here. I essentially get all the makers of the next generation of technology coming and trying to explain what that brings. And you didn't really write a technology book. You wrote a human nature book. Many people are worried that human nature is about to surrender to artificial intelligence. What do you say to those people?
You're right to worry. I mean, AI is incredible. It could go any which way. One concern and one actual motivation for the book is that what we are teaching AIs about humans is not what we should be teaching them. Like, AIs basically learn off the internet. That is the database on which they are figuring out how to be smart and how to you know, give us more of same. Well, I don't really want them learning off today's internet, because today's internet is full of so much darkness and savagery and unpleasantness. There's a good side of humans that's what I want AI to learn from. And I feel it's like it's an incredibly important agenda for anyone who's working on AI. And this is what I'll say to them is, please, please, please don't look at what humans do. Look at how humans reflectively think. Like, we all know that there is a better version of ourselves than some of what we do. And so it's AI is just like we ourselves have to tap into our reflective minds. That's what AI needs to do as well. AI should not be looking at the fast news. It should be looking at the slow news, James. So thank you, by the way.
Well, we'll get right back to work. But let's finish there, if you would, because let's talk about the real challenge of slow and reflective thinking in a world in which movement of information is accelerating. And just on a very practical basis, I suspect that what you're trying to figure out at TED is not that different from what we're trying to work out at Tortoise, which is, if you've asked people to spend some time really thinking through a complex problem, yes, you need to have some discipline about the way in which those ideas are then communicated. But there can be too much discipline. It's one thing to say, we're going to give you a number of minutes. It's another thing altogether to say, communicate it in a number of seconds. And when you look at TikTok or WhatsApp or Instagram or all of the most viral social media, the place where information can be most infectious, it's often asking for the delivery of information in incredibly short, fast bursts. Mm. How do you encourage people? How do you package the ideas that are coming out of TED in such a way that they speak to a reflective mind?
It's incredibly hard to win the attention battle. As Louis von Ahn, the founder of Duolingo, said at the last TED, you know, Duolingo is trying to teach people language. He says we're trying to offer broccoli in a sea of dessert. You know, it's very, very hard to do. And so they figured out that you have to use some of the techniques of dessert to bring it into what they're doing. On his calculation, he actually has a graph that says we don't have to completely make it all dessert. 30% of it can be carried by humans' good intentions and reflective desire. The rest needs a bit of a boost. And so in Duolingo, you have all these things like streaks and leagues and all these other things that boost addictiveness. But it's in service of a good cause. And I think all of us have to figure out the same way. When you try and come in with your lead headlines every time, you've got to tap into interest where it is and then maybe pull people on a journey to say, now let's dig deeper. Come on, slow down. Let's go into this and really understand it. We're trying to do the same at TED. And we're up against TikTok and so forth. Where I get some hope is that some of the people who are doing this most brilliantly are actually coming up with content that is not dark and ugly. It's beautiful. I mean, I look at Mr. Beast and, you know, here's Jimmy Donaldson, who's Mr. Beast, has spent 10 years now, I think, plus, trying to crack the code of YouTube. And his videos, he now has 200 people working for him, plus. His videos, within a week of being launched, are seen by more than 50 million people, and many of them, like, in the hundreds of millions. This is more than any multi-billion dollar corporation can achieve. And what his videos are not threats about look who's coming across the border or this, that, or the other. It is delight, incredible kind of craziness. Like some of it is big, crazy stunts or whatever. A lot of it is kindness. Mm. Hey, look how I gave away $100,000. You know, it is hilarious and funny. But he is inspiring millions and millions in the next generation to think that kindness can be cool. And his style may not be for everyone, and he's not solving every problem in the deepest possible way. But it is incredibly encouraging to me that those tools of what will spread can actually apply to the good stuff as well as to the dark stuff.
And you see that in the book, these instances where like moments of kindness become viral, the umbrella, the train, these moments that are so indelible when we catch them on social media, are they, to your mind, almost always accidental? Can they be crafted and curated, or are they just moments where people catch, perhaps that's its authenticity, right, is that they catch a moment of human nature?
I think they are often accidental, and you know, if you see something and can capture it and can share it, that's actually good, because the ripple effects from that can be beautiful. But no, they are done intentionally. You know, this group in Japan who wanted to clean up litter in their streets thought, you know, they'd go out and do that and capture it on video. But they put some thought into it. They dressed up as samurai warriors with swords, and they sort of stab the litter and flick it up and catch it in the basket. And it was so awesome looking at that video that the videos go viral. And so thousands of other groups form. That was done with absolute intent. And there's many examples of that, of people who've just thought, how do I crack the code here? I think all of us who are in the business of trying to spread the good stuff, don't give up. We can't give up on it. It's let's be smart here. Let's be creative. Let's be bold. And then all bets are off.
Do you look at the generosity you see around and the kindness you see around and think that the world of politics and the media is essentially talking about humanity in a very specific register, but the bulk of human life is something else?
I think that may well be true. I think, you know, at TED we've sometimes had a saying, politicians come and go, ideas are forever. I actually think history is shaped more by the builders, the dreamers, the scientists who are discovering, the people who shape culture, than by politics. And especially today, politics has got so noisy and so zero sum. It's like it's a big tug of war in a giant mud bath, and it goes this way a bit and that way a bit, and it's just a mess. And so, at some point, I think the more interesting stories are come out of that zero sum, one dimensional battle, and start dreaming a bit about other possibilities. The world's full of underexplored possibilities about the future. This is human superpower, to dream up other ways of framing and thinking about the future. And if you go there, you can discover wonder and delight and possibility. And that's where I find hope. I don't say that the future is going to be better or that we'll solve any of this, but I feel like the role of determined optimist is to at least look for a possible pathway forward and to shine a light on it. And then hopefully some others get excited about that and we'll try it.
Chris Anson, thank you for bringing your determined optimism into our newsroom. Heaven knows this one and all others could do with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
Tortoise.
I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra, and Cleopatra's nose,
follow Legacy Now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.